I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee. We do have a quorum present, and Representative Huntley, I see you've got some paper out. Have you looked at the minutes?
I would move the minutes from Tuesday, April 1st.
Very good. The motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. I was looking carefully when it reminded me April 1st to make sure that they were truly the right minutes. I don't think Ms. Bolkamp would...
Mr. Chair, and I was not talking when you called on me.
No, I was looking for somebody that was talking. I had that conversation with Representative Hornsby. He told me that that's a well-used technique. Representative Hornstein?
You can see, Mr. Chair, it had the desired effect.
That's right. Okay, we've got House File 2536. This is the Women's Economic Security Act that's up first. And Representative Moline, welcome back. You've been here now 2 days in a row, so you've got a pretty good idea of our procedures now, I think. But... I'll move that House File 2536, the first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the general register. I understand there's one author's amendment. Do you want to do that before you present the bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for having me back again.
And the chair moves the
A13 amendment.
The A13th amendment then, and Representative Moline on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There are a couple... oral amendments to the amendment. I don't know if you want to go through those first or have me go through the amendment.
I think
first.
The desire is to get the bill in the shape that you would like. So, your choice. Do you want to do the amendment first and then the oral amendments? Is that what
you're
asking?
Sure, sure.
Okay. The amendment then, if you could explain the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this Women's Economic Security Act is a compilation of several bills that have moved through the legislature separately, carried by all different authors. And the amendment that we're adding today is to incorporate a couple more of those provisions that went through the committee process. And the first would be the equal pay compliance reporting on the A13 amendment, and there's been significant efforts to address concerns from the business community, and this provision that we're adding in was originally carried, or is being carried, by Representative Moran, and the language would require state contractors with 50 or more employees with contracts over $500,000 to secure a certificate of equal pay compliance to ensure they are complying with current state and federal equal pay laws. And it allows for the commissioner of the Department of Human Rights to audit a business to ensure they are complying with equal pay laws and may require a business to implement a plan to remedy non-compliance. And in that specific provision of the bill would be the oral amendment on page 6 to pay for the equal pay provision, and it would be on page 6, line 1.3, insert $674,000, and on page 6, line 6.15, insert $426,000.
Okay. You're incorporating that into your amendment then?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any discussion? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, on the very first page, you referred to equal pay. That means something to a business owner who actually signs paychecks. For the purposes of this amendment, though, do you actually mean comparable pay, or do you actually mean equal pay?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Beard. Representative Moran's bill started out as a pay equity bill, which would be more along the lines of a comparable pay bill. This amendment is more equal pay than would be pay equity. Although, you know, it's maybe a step in the right direction as far as achieving pay equity, but the intent of it after lots of negotiations, and I don't think that it's perfect yet for the business community, but incorporating a lot of their concerns, it is now more of an equal pay provision.
Representative Beard is that?
Well, no, Madam.
Representative Beard.
That's fine. Well, just wanted to address the concern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have a couple fiscal questions, and then it's my understanding that there's language contained in this amendment that wasn't heard in the policy bills, and I know there are people in the audience that have concerns with it, and given we're doing policy changes here that haven't been vetted in the proper committees, I'm hoping that the chair, as he's done in the past, will allow some latitude to allow those individuals to speak to the A13 amendment. But I'd like to start with the fiscal issue first. In inserting the numbers that you did in your oral amendment, Representative Moline, it looks like you are using the numbers off of the fiscal note based on a 3A, the bill number -3A, completed on April 1st, and this is an A13 amendment, and I can already at first glance see that the assumptions in the fiscal note do not match the amendment, in that the fiscal note states that it would be exempt employers with less than 40 employees, and I see on page 1 of the amendment that number has been changed to 50. So can you tell me why the numbers did not change when you changed the numbers in your amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the fiscal note I'm working off of for the Department of Human Services is dated yesterday, April 1st, maybe. Is that what you were asking?
Mr. Chair, the fiscal note that we have in our packet is, it reflects bill number 2873 or maybe 2573-3A. I guess it's 2373-3A. And if you go to page 3 of that fiscal note, and under the assumptions, the third paragraph, it states that this fiscal note has been written to a standard of contractors that have less than 40 employees. The amendment has a standard of contractors of less than 50 employees, so this no longer matches. There should be at least some reduction in cost, because I'm assuming there's some employers that have somewhere between 40 and 50 employees that would no longer be affected by the amendment as you're presented, being different than the fiscal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the Department of Human Rights is here to address that question. Although there are other pieces to the amendment, I don't know if you want me to go through the entire amendment and then go to questions on the amendment, or if you want to just stick with questions right now. But there is somebody here from the Department of Human Rights that can address Representative Holberg's question.
Well, being that the question has been posed, my original intent was for you to go through the amendment and then take questions, but we had a couple of hands that went up right away. So, being that we're into it, if somebody from the Department of Human Rights can come forward and address the question. And if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Butel. I'm the legislative liaison with the Department of Human Rights. Commissioner Lindsay should be here shortly, but in the meantime, I will take a swing at this as well, since I was briefed on this. So for the fiscal note that's being discussed on this, I believe that this was updated yesterday in discussion with MMB's renewed request for an update, and so I think it is possible that the draft number that's on the fiscal note was not updated at this time, but I know that the current amendment, the A13 amendment that's before the committee today, was the one that was reviewed by the department. To Representative Holberg's question, the assumption that's being used by the department in terms of number of certificates is based on conversations that the department had with the Department of Administration that provided a list of current state contracts that are over $500,000. I believe that the number of those contracts that admin identified was 1,114. The Department of Administration in their record-keeping system does not track the number of contractors. So we are making kind of a best, you know, honestly a best guess educated estimate on how many of those contractors may fall below that threshold of 50. And based kind of on our experience with the certificate, the affirmative action certificate of compliance that the department currently issues, and kind of the ratio of those with contracts for the Department of Admin, we felt that this was a, you know, the kind of best guess assumption that we could make in providing this information to the committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, and the problem is that the assumptions in this fiscal note use a threshold of 40 employees, not 50, as what's in the amendment. And so how does that change the computations on the costs?
Mr. Buettel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert. Based on, as I said, based on the list that the Department of Administration that was able to provide us, they do not track the number of employees that these contractors have. So we are basing this kind of as a best guess estimate of how many would likely fall below that threshold, given that these are companies with contracts over $500,000. In our conversations with Department of Administration, other agencies, we believe that that number is relatively small, and so hence the reason for our estimation with that list of 1,114, guessing that, you know, approximately 100 of them are going to be peeled off. We do not believe that there would be many contractors that would fall into that 40 to 50 threshold, and I believe that's the reason why the number in the assumption was not changed when the amendment was adopted, or when the amendment was proposed.
Well, Mr. Chair, are you telling me that the department had the A13 amendment yesterday and just failed to change the assumptions in the fiscal note to reflect the right number of 50 instead of 40?
Mr. Buettel.
I'm sorry, I was getting whispered into both ears at the same time. Would you mind restating the question?
Well, Mr. Chair, what document did you have yesterday when you, or whatever day the first was, yesterday, what document did you use to prepare your fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, we use the A13 amendment that's before the committee right now.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I'm curious then, why didn't you change the assumptions in your fiscal note to reflect that it now says on line 10 of the amendment that you're only going to subject this policy to businesses that have 50 or more employees? The assumption on page 3 of your fiscal note still has 40.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I believe that not having made that change from 40 to 50 was an oversight, and I apologize.
Representative Holberg.
And Mr. Chair, so is the department saying there's no employees between subject to this with contracts in excess of $500,000 that have between 40 and 49 employees?
Mr. Buettel, or Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I'll let the department answer that, but I think that most of the costs incurred by the Department of Human Rights have to do with auditing, so I'm not sure that the number of audits would change just because there are perhaps fewer employers who would be subject to the certificate, and I guess in my opinion that would be why the cost wouldn't necessarily shift that much, because it wouldn't necessarily mean that the number of audits conducted by the department would be changing.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, on page 3 of the fiscal note, you also they also assume 250 contractors would pay this additional fee of $150. Are you also saying you don't think that number would change?
Which of you? Buettel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that 250 number you know, again, is based on the best information that was available from the Department of Administration that tracks these contracts. We were basing that on this certificate of compliance would be good for 4 years, and so we, in crafting the assumptions in this note, broke down the 1,000 number by 4 years to indicate that that revenue would be spread out, because clearly not all of these certificates would be issued in 1 year.
And if I might, just one additional question. Representative Moline, what was the rationale from changing the number from 40 to 50?
Representative Moline. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, I believe that request came from the business community.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, to add to that, I believe that on lines 2.5 through 2.10 in the discussion of the EEO-1 employment information, which is a federal program, I believe that for a certain threshold within that program falls under 50, and I believe that was the business community's rationale for requesting that change from 40 to 50 to align with that federal program.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to hearing from the business community on this amendment.
Okay, if you want to complete the explanation of the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. On page 4 of the amendment, line 4.12 is the report on the establishment of a state-administered retirement savings plan. This comes as a compromise from a Representative Fritz bill and would require the Commissioner of Management and Budget to conduct a study of private and public solutions to our state's retirement needs and report back to the legislature by July 15, 2015. On 6.18, originally some of you probably heard about a Representative Lesch bill dealing with sick time. That is essentially out of the bill entirely, but as a compromise, we're allowing some additional use of existing sick time. Adding to some changes we had made last year, I believe, and this simply allows accumulated already earned sick time to be used for the care of a grandchild. And line 7.22 of the amendment, this has to do with the pregnancy accommodations aspect of the bill, and it requires an interactive process related to the request for an accommodation and includes undue hardship language for employers relating to temporary transfers. And the last part of the A13 amendment removes the $5,000 cap on early learning scholarships, which is a separate bill that's also moved through committee. Oh, and Mr. Chair, on page 6, line 28, Senate Council had made a drafting error, and we need to delete the words "the employee's assistance" on page 6, line 28.
Representative Moline, I had a conversation going on. Were you done?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that completes the A13 amendment. Other than that oral amendment, which is line 6.28, to strike the words "the employee's assistance."
Now, if Representative Holberg has a question of the business community, that's fine, but what I was checking on, and it's my understanding that all of this has gone to one policy committee or another, but that's fine. I'm not going to debate that. If she has a question of the business community, we'll entertain that before we adopt the amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think what the concern is that the A13 contains language that was not discussed in committee, and that there's been changes, that it's not the language that passed out of committee.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, all of the bills that are in the A13 and in the bill made it through committee. I think the specific language that you're talking about is, which is the biggest holdup we still have with the business community, is on lines 2.1 of the amendment, where it is, we use the words mitigating factors instead of market conditions. When the bill was first introduced and first heard, we didn't have the market condition. The market conditions language wasn't in the bill. Market conditions was amended on in the last policy committee, and now it's back to mitigating factors. Other than that language, I'm not aware, and like I said, it wasn't in the original bill either, but all these provisions have gone through the policy committees.
Representative Holbert.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
But if you have a specific question or area, we'll entertain that.
I appreciate that.
If there's concern, we can certainly we'll ask. I'm not sure who will be their spokesperson before we adopt the amendment or vote on the amendment. Representative Loon, but we're looking for somebody that was going to come forward to Representative Loon, did you have something before they comment? Or
well, I think I'll just allow the business witness to testify first, and then I'll follow up with a question.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Jill Larson. I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I will speak just to the issue of the policy change language since the bill came out of the last policy committee. Representative Moline referenced this. I have had conversations with her about this issue, we have requested some changes in the language that I understand will not be made today. We hope we will continue to work with the author and leadership on this. The issue is this. When the bill came out of the Public Safety Finance Committee, in lines 2.5 to 2.10, employers are allowed to take into consideration certain factors when making compensation decisions, including factors such as market conditions. We actually wanted to add some language that included language that we would be able to take into consideration other factors other than sex. That is language that is in the current equal pay for equal work law in Minnesota statute, and we thought that would make it clearer. Our concern is that not only was that additional language not added, the terms market conditions was deleted for this amendment for this committee. And if we are not able to use take into account whether it be market conditions or factors other than sex, we won't be able to take into consideration something like supply and demand, that if we're maybe paying an engineer more than a loan officer because of the way the market works, that the market for engineers is such that you need to pay them more, the way this bill is written right now, we would be potentially out of compliance and potentially have our contract with the state revoked. So it is quite concerning. I think we also saw in the fiscal note, it says that the Office of Administrative Hearings assumes that the Department of Human Rights could void 5% of the contracts. Now, if the fiscal note says that they're going to issue 1,000 certificates, so 5% of 1,000 is potentially 50 contracts voided. I know those are assumptions, but those are the things that concern us. So I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Okay, and I don't know if Representative Loon's questions of you or not, Ms. Larson. So Representative Loon, while she's there, if there are any other questions of Ms. Larson. Representative Anderson of Ms. Larson. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Larson, can you tell me what kind of the, what I think it was 1,114 employers or businesses here in the state of Minnesota that would be doing these kinds of contracts, what kind of fiscal impact would this language have on them, and how does that impact the costs that the state has for contracts in general? So when we're asking for bids on a project, do you have any idea, at this moment at least, what kind of cost increase that we're going to see because of this and the impact it could have on the bidding process? And the projects. Can you kind of go over that with me, if you could?
Ms. Larson.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, members. The short answer is we don't know, but we do know that many of our members have federal contracts, and they are required to comply with the federal equal pay for equal work law, and they go through extensive audits through the federal government to ensure compliance, and those audits can be extremely costly. Just a regular desk audit might cost $80,000 and take several years. Our concern is that this bill as written creates a separate, different state audit process that could be an additional cost. And the concern is that I think if employers are not sure that their contract might be voided if they're somehow out of compliance, and this vague language, they don't know if they will be out of compliance, there may be employers who just choose not to bid on state contracts because they don't want to take that risk. And so I think there is the potential that not only will there be increased costs to the businesses, which probably will be passed on to the state in terms of higher contract costs, but there may be some Minnesota businesses that just choose not to bid on the contracts, and that might be that the state doesn't get the best contractor for the job.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
I think that's it. Thank you, Ms. Larson.
Thanks for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Loom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, you know, just honing in on what seems to be still an area of disagreement or concern with the business community and yourself on that specific line to 2.10, what would constitute a mitigating factor? I mean, that's, to me, in reading that, it sounds a little bit like the term reasonable, which we could all define a little bit differently. So what... I think the business community is looking for some more specifics in talking about things like market forces and that. So what would fall under mitigating factors? What's your intent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I had the same question of the business community on defining market conditions, and I think I did meet with Ms. Larson yesterday, and we're having ongoing discussions if maybe a better solution would be to better define what some of these provisions mean in lines 2.5 to 2.10, because, you know, they explained to me what their interpretation of market conditions was, but without having it defined, we had some concerns about that as well. And I know that the pay equity advocates and the business community were unable to agree on that specific language of what would be market conditions and mitigating factors. But if I can work with them, the business community, and try to maybe narrow down the definition of what would be mitigating factors, maybe it can address some of both of our concerns going forward. And I'd be happy to do that.
Mr. Chair, well, you know, I certainly hope that discussions will ensue, because obviously there's still concerns here, I think very serious concerns that need to be addressed. But Representative Moline, in Ms. Larson's testimony, she mentioned a specific example of, you know, a engineer versus a loan officer and the term supply and demand. In that specific example, is that... would that be your intent, that that would be a valid mitigating factor?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loon. There was a couple of things that Ms. Larson cited as examples and that I discussed with her in my office yesterday that I think would be valid mitigating factors in consideration for the compliance. And so if I can continue to meet with them and possibly include some of their ideas and what would be considered a mitigating factor, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would supply and demand for a specific type of employee that may be in high demand and in short supply, would that be a mitigating factor in your opinion?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline. I don't know if I'm prepared to say absolutely yes or no right at this time, but I think that it's something that I'm willing to consider. Like I said, the concerns that she had raised to me yesterday, and using the example of supply and demand, well, what if there's a higher paying job where only two people apply and a lower paying job where 40 people apply? Or maybe they're, you know, the same amount of pay, but there's more applicants in one than there is in the other, and then you would have to possibly, to make it more competitive, there would be a different pay. I think that those are things that I think are valid concerns and considerations. I'm just not prepared right now to say that I would absolutely consider that as a mitigating factor, but I would be interested in having a better definition of either mitigating factor or market conditions, depending on what language we use going forward.
Representative, is that it?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I've belabored this enough, but I just have real concerns. I think, you know, with the business community, with the specific example, has pointed out, is that this is a very litigation-rich environment in which we can't even agree on what, you know, something like market factors would be, or supply and demand would be a mitigating factor. So I just point that out as a real concern, Representative Moline.
Okay, Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going back to the fiscal note here as I try and chew my way through it. And if you go to page 6 of the fiscal note, the Office of Administrative Hearings under item number 4 has relied upon the Department of Human Rights estimate that approximately 13 certificates of pay equity compliance would be issued annually. And if you go back to page 3 of the fiscal note, it says 250 contractors, and with a guesstimate of 5% requiring a hearing. If you look on page 6, you go back to less than one per year, but if, in fact, the number is 250 certificates a year, 5% of that is far more than less than one.
Looks like somebody's prepared to address that.
Mr. Chair,
identify yourself for the record.
Kevin Lindsay, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights.
Okay, and Representative Moline, you were about to say something when I asked him to identify himself. So,
no, Mr. Chair, I was just going to introduce Commissioner Lindsay to the committee, and I think he'd be able to answer the questions regarding the fiscal note that the department prepared.
Commissioner Lindsay.
Representative Holberg, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe the earlier draft, the very first draft as relates to the fiscal note, that's a Scrivener's error as relates to the 13. But let me go through your question as to what do we expect the number of certificates that we would get each year. So that we asked the Department of Administration as to how many contracts currently are in force which would meet the definition and be subject to the scope of the proposed bill. They identified 1,114 contracts. Unfortunately, the Department of Administration is unable to tell us out of those 1,114 contracts where the employer has less than 40 employees. So what we have done is taken a rough estimate, assumed 114 would fall out. We then divided, because it would be a four-year length for the certificate, and we divided to 250. My assumption is that we probably will experience slightly more than 250 certificates in the first year. Years 3-4, it will level out, and then we will, from that point on, evenly probably issue around 250 certificates if the total number is around 1,000.
And Mr. Chair,
I'm Holbert.
So if we go back to page 6 of the fiscal note, where the Office Administrative Hearings has relied on 13 certificates a year being issued as opposed to 250 or maybe more in the first year, if you take their cost of $990 a year per hearing, you would have significant more cost than what's reflected on page 5 of the fiscal note. In other words, you would have to take that figure of $990 and 5% of the 250, which let's just say, you know, for sake, where, you know, we go by 10 or whatever, your fiscal note is not accurate given the language in the bill and the differing assumptions. So, I mean, I'm not even sure who signed off on this, but you have on one page of the bill an assumption of 250 by your own testimony, likely more in the first year, and Office Administrative Hearing using a number of 13 for their cost.
Mr.
Representative Holman, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I think there's another assumption in there which I would disagree with from the Office of Administrative Hearing, and that is the number of hearings as relates for voiding of contracts. And I would go on that on the basis of the experience that I have seen and then looking at the history of voiding contracts by the Department of Human Rights in the area of workforce participation. That number, as far as I know, we have not had a situation in which we've actually had a dispute which ended up before the Office of Administrative Hearing in over 30 years. So with that background, that history, if that is to educate us going forward, I think really the expected cost from conducting a hearing before the Office of Administrative Hearing when a contract is void probably is, I'll round up from that 990, 1,000 is probably the accurate number there.
Well, Mr. Chair, the point is that $1,000 you need to multiply not by less than one, but you need to multiply it by 5% of 250, because your section of the fiscal note and your own testimony says 250 or more in the first year, and the Office Administrative Hearing states real clearly that they're relying on your estimate of 13 certificates a year.
Representative Holberg, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I apologize if I was not clear, Representative Holberg. What I'm saying is that currently we have over 1,700 certificates in force right now in workforce compliance. And over the 30 years for the Department of Human Rights going back into history, so I'll roughly estimate over 45,000 certificates have been issued. I am unaware of any instance in which we have been before the Office of Administrative Hearing for voiding a contract. So with awaiting a 45,000 contracts, if you're talking about 250, the experience tells me it's infinitesimal. It is not even to 1%. So the likelihood of actually having a hearing, even if we issue 250 in fiscal year 250, I would say zero. Well, it's not an increase in cost.
And Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I feel your pain. Quite frequently, I disagree mm-hmm. with assumptions in fiscal notes and don't think it should cost so much or that they've got it wrong. But the reality is that we base spending decisions on fiscal notes. And if you compare the assumptions of the Office Administrative Hearing with your numbers that have been provided by your department, they don't line up. And so you need to maybe have a discussion with the Office Administrative Hearing and convince them that their 5% factor is wrong, and we need a fiscal note that reflects a lower factor. But we certainly have a problem in the fiscal note, and that the difference between 13 and more than 250 is significant in reflecting what actual costs may or might be.
Representative Holberg, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I agree that there can be differences as relates to the assumption. I am here to provide information as relates from my vantage point of the department as relates to the underlying facts for that assumption. From our vantage point, that number is too high.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, one last question.
Representative Holberg.
Then why did your department sign off on this fiscal note?
Commissioner.
I don't recall seeing language from the Office of Administrative Hearing with the 5% number attached to it for hearings.
Well,
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, this is very unusual that you'd have such a large discrepancy between two departments in a final fiscal note. It was always my understanding that before a department signed off on it, that they looked at the interactions in the fiscal note, and the scope of the difference of numbers and assumptions in this fiscal note are quite large.
Okay. Now, before we vote on the amendment, I want to clarify what the oral amendment was, because people were kind of coming and going. So, Mr. Shepherd, do you want to point out, I think it's on page 6, that we need to have some clarification before people understand.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe there were three places on page 6 where whoever was going to make the oral amendment was going to incorporate changes. And the first is on line 13 to fill in the blank with $674,000. The second one on page 6, line 15, would be to delete the blank and insert $426,000. And the third one on page 6, line 28, would be to delete the words "the employee's assistance."
Okay, and that was incorporated by the author. or by the by me. I'm the author. Yes, because she's not on the committee. Okay, that was incorporated by me with the understanding that that was what the author wanted to, of the bill wanted to have happen. Now we're clear. Okay, any further discussion, Representative Marquardt?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And looking at lines 8.13 to 8.16 on the early learning scholarships, I see here they're, the commissioner's allowed to kind of look at a target there. And we did look at that in education finance and did not go with that just because if you do raise the level of the scholarships, without additional money, you may have to reduce the number of kids served. So we did not do that in the education finance bill. However, the Senate does have $12 million for early childhood scholarships in their bill, so there will be debate on that later. So this is fine, but I did want to make that note so members were aware of what the Education Finance Committee did. So thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor of the A13 amendment as it was modified, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and to the bill as amended. Again, this is a compilation of several bills that have gone through committee with different authors, and I just want to acknowledge the work that's gone into this bill from Representative Morgan, Representative Yaruso, Representative Kahn, Representative Mason, Representative Rosenthal, Representative Fritz, Representative Seltzer. We've all carried these bills individually through committees and come before you today with the omnibus bill. And Mr. Chair and members, just to go through the other fiscal implications of the bill, the first would be on Article 2, Section 5, regarding a $500,000 appropriation to DEED for women in high-wage, high-demand, non-traditional jobs grants program, which was heard in Representative Mahoney's committee. Article 2, Section 6, a $500,000 grant to DEED to promote the creation of women-owned businesses. And just to clarify, Mr. Chair, these are one-time appropriations. And Article 2, Section 7, $250,000 grant to DALI for labor education advancement program, support apprenticeships in high-wage, high-demand, non-traditional occupations. All these grants and appropriations go towards our goal of helping women entrepreneurs and women get into higher income jobs and occupations in order to close that pay gap between men and women. And the other appropriations in the bill, Mr. Chair, would be the page 6, section 9, regarding the retirement savings plan report that we went through in the A13 amendment, $300,000 appropriation to one-time appropriation to Minnesota Management and Budget, and then the page 6, section 7, regarding the appropriations to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights that we just went through, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer questions from members on the other fiscal impacts of the bill. Mr. Chair, just to clarify too, it wasn't clear in the language on two of the appropriations that they were one-time appropriations to DEED and DALI. And so on page 8, line 13, we need to, after the period, insert this is a one-time appropriation. And again, on
line
page
31 is what staff indicated.
Yep. Line 31 on page 8. After the period, insert this is a one-time appropriation. And then also on page 9, line 35, after the period, insert, this is a one-time appropriation.
Okay, everybody have that? Mr. Martin, we're clear on that then. Okay, I'll move those changes then to assure that it's a one-time appropriation. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Were you done on the explanation then of the bill? And
yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, on line 1.9 of the A13, you referenced no department or agency of the state. Is this bill all-inclusive of all agencies of the state of Minnesota?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, yes, that's my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, how many... Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, how many of the 1,114 contracts would be MnDOT contracts?
Representative Moline?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I think the Minnesota Department of Human Rights might have some idea, although as we heard earlier, it's difficult to know exactly how many contracts would fall under that sort of purview. I don't know if they're able to answer more clearly or not on that.
Welcome back, Commissioner.
Representative Member, Chair and members of the committee, at this point in time, we haven't been able to aggregate that data from the Department of Administration, crosswalk it with our data as relates to the Department of Transportation. Anecdotally, it feels like it's probably a couple hundred of those contractors which would be subject to this.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moline, I'm trying to figure this out. Nowhere in the fiscal note do I see any cost to MnDOT to add this to their work. And this clearly will have a cost to MnDOT. It's going to have to be put in their specifications and all their projects. And then... one, maybe I'll first ask that. Why is there not a fiscal cost to MnDOT? And really, are you saying there's only 200 contracts in the entire agency of MnDOT per year in excess of $500,000? Seriously?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, just for clarity, it's for businesses with 50 or more full-time employees in this state or in other states. So I think that reduces the number of contracts that would qualify. Obviously, a lot of transportation contracts are over $500,000, but that doesn't necessarily mean that those contractors have 50 employees or more. So I think that that's why the number is down as low as it would be. I'm not aware of why there would be a cost to MnDOT or other state agencies in regards to the Equal Pay Certificate. As it's the Department of Human Rights that issues the certificate to the contractor or to the business, and then it's the Department of Human Rights that does the audit. And so the costs incurred associated with that are associated with the Department of Human Rights.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, do you intend to include language in MnDOT's request for proposals about these requirements?
Representative Chair, members of the committee, the bid package that may be submitted, it might have one page which would indicate the affirmance as relates to compliance. Currently for the workforce participation certificate, there is one page which is already included. We would work to try and just simply add a couple of sentences to the existing page which already exists.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moline, or Commissioner, you've got some things in here that actually, I think, take MnDOT down the path of pre-qualification. You're requiring this certificate to be done. They're supposed to have this certificate. MnDOT does not have a policy of pre-qualification today. I believe in here you're actually requiring contractors to have pre-qualification in this. Where does the 15-day time period, where does that apply in the current MnDOT time frame for award of contract? And are you seriously saying there's going to be no cost to MnDOT to check on this pre-qualification and confirm that they meet this, and you're going to add a sentence about this requirement in the bid package? Are you familiar with the MnDOT bid package today and how extensive these requirements are? And they're going to add one sentence about this?
Representative Chair and members of the committee, we actually had a lean event with MnDOT officials, admin officials, and other contracting agencies within the state, specifically addressing the question of whether there are exempt contractors being awarded bids. So to your point, as relates to obtaining information, verifying that that business is either subject to workforce participation or to this new language, we have already begun that respective process. So I do believe that it is possible that it can be done within the 15-day time period. We are currently issuing and reviewing workforce participation certificates in less than 4 days.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moline, where is what MnDOT is going to spend to do this in the fiscal note? This is a significant change in MnDOT's call for bids. This is a significant, significant change in how they do business. They're the major contracting agency in the state of Minnesota. And this is, you're putting this on the backs of the people doing business with MnDOT. How are they going to know about this? And are we going to throw bids out when they aren't aware of this? Because I understand, right? And then let me ask that. And are you going to have a separate form in here for them to sign off on this? Or is this going to be an assumption when they sign the bottom line of the bid package that they understand this? And where are they going to see this? Is this going to be incorporated into MnDOT's specification book in their next update? And is it going to be listed in the special provisions of each proposal as they currently do it before the spec book is updated, which is only done every 5 years?
Representative, Commissioner, Chair, and members of the committee, maybe it would be helpful to take a step back as relates to currently for workforce participations. 363A36 already requires MnDOT or any bid awarding agency to verify that the exempt status of a contractor before entering into a contract. So there already is a process in place for doing that. And we work hand in glove with MnDOT and all other bid awarding agencies along that line. So I do appreciate the fact and the sensitivity around that, but I do believe that we already have a process in place which can address all the concerns which you raise. And I don't see the respective concerns that you have about broadening sort of the responsibilities of MnDOT. Currently, right now, in determining the exempt status, we're the ones who get the information as it relates to contractors who've been awarded a bid. We then go and then confirm whether they're exempt or not. So MnDOT is not in that business right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, so nothing's going to change with how MnDOT's doing it. That's why there's nothing in the fiscal note for that. The agency doesn't need to change anything. So what's the purpose of the bill then?
Commissioner.
Representative, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, we're talking about the enterprise of awarding a contract. And there are various components of awarding a contract. We play a part. Department of Administration plays a part. A contracting agency plays a part. So the part in awarding the contract in its totality, the what's going to change is the information we receive on the exempt status for this particular subject matter. MnDOT's portion, as relates to how you articulated, the various specifications on how either a bridge is built or how a road is developed or what we're doing at the St. Croix Lift Bridge project or St. Croix Bridge project, that's not going to change. And to that extent, MnDOT has invited 8 agencies to collaborate on the St. Croix Bridge project because we all touch on various parts of that respective project. We all have a part to play. The work of the enterprise doesn't change, but all of us working together collaboratively, we can all figure out how to do that better.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, Representative Moline, I still am trying to understand. This is a significant change in MnDOT's policy. This is a requirement of 15 days time frame that has to happen prior to award. And if I understand you right, you're saying that it will not be explained in the bid specifications. You're going to add a sentence about it. How will a contractor from South Dakota, North Dakota, bidding on a project in Ortonville, Minnesota, going to realize that this requirement is in place now by one sentence? Is it going to have a separate form by MnDOT that says, you know, you're complying with the new equal pay certificate of compliance, and here's the information where to go, which I would think MnDOT needs to do? This is a significant change in business and how they currently operate, and that's fine if that's what the legislature deems we're going to do. But MnDOT is the major contracting agency in the state of Minnesota, and nowhere are they in the fiscal note. How are they going to incorporate it into these contracts? Do you know that this has day after enactment? What is going to happen to the contracts that are out for bid for the 21-day pre-notice? How is that going to work? How are you incorporating this? And how is the agency with the largest contracting responsibility in the state of Minnesota going to meet this law with no fiscal note?
Representative, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the earlier responses that I gave is that we're talking about an enterprise-wide approach as it relates to the solicitation, the bid awarding process, the role that we play already within MnDOT. We work hand in glove with them to determine whether a contractor is exempt or not. So I hear your concerns, but rest assured we'll be working with MnDOT and all of the bid contracting agencies to ensure that there's no additional burdens borne by them.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Moleen, this has a fiscal cost to MnDOT. You people should go, excuse me, folks should go and get a solicitation for bids from MnDOT and what it references in the different specifications. MnDOT is not used to incorporating something like this into their specifications with day after enactment with no fiscal cost. There are serious implications. Sure. You may want to throw a bid out now that's bid over the next time frame with this day after enactment, and there's going to be the question of, well, is it the responsible low bidder? Did they meet the qualification? Mr. Chair, I can keep going, but the next one I want to know, does it apply to subcontractors? I can't see anywhere in here. We have numerous. We could have a second-tier subcontractor with 50 employees. Is that considered a contract, or are you only concerned about the general contractor? So if a general contractor has 49 employees, but they have two first-tier subs with 75 employees, are they subjected to this?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, it does not apply to subcontractors as currently written. And also, I did just want to point out that the effective date is August 1st, not effective immediately.
Okay, Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair, just one final question. Representative Moline, it's my understanding this may not apply to MnDOT. That was my original question, if you remember right. And I guess if we could get a clarification, Mr. Chair, it's been brought to my attention that this bill may not even apply to MnDOT. And I guess that would be the most important thing. I'm not sure if we've gotten a clarification on that. If it does apply to MnDOT, the fiscal note needs to be corrected, and we need to clarify some of this day after enactment with MnDOT and them bidding on a constant. I guess I'd like to know, Representative Moline, whether it applies to MnDOT. Clearly, before it leaves the committee, we should know that.
Yeah.
Is anybody present from MnDOT that could give a quick yes or no?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackermann, I don't think anyone from MnDOT is here. This language has been out there for quite some time. This is a language that went through committee. I have never heard from MnDOT that they have any concerns with the language whatsoever, or even any questions with the language, but I'd be happy to ask them whether or not they have questions or concerns. But like I said, this language has been out there for quite some time now, and I haven't heard from them.
I'm done.
And I think if it does, the commissioner has indicated that you already work hand in glove with them, so... But it sounds like Representative Moline will check on that.
Mr.
Do we have somebody else here that's
I just have a brief word to say.
You are, we generally, okay, well, identify yourself.
My name is Matt Harold. I work for MnDOT. I am not of authority to speak on this matter. However, I wanted to ensure the committee that I will pass along these issues that have been raised.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative Anderson.
Can we ask our staff, our research staff here, and what their interpretation is of this?
We can certainly ask that, but okay, are you done then? You're going to pass the word on to make sure that they're communicated with. Mr. Shepherd, do you have a comment on that question?
Mr. Chair and members, just two thoughts. I don't see anything here that excludes MnDOT. There was an earlier version of the bill a long time ago when the bill was quite different that excluded MnDOT. This, I don't believe this does. And the effective date is on page 3, line 33. It's August 1st.
Okay. So that's where we stand right now then. Right, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if the commissioner wouldn't mind coming back to a question, I'm trying to get a handle on sort of the magnitude of the problem that portions of this bill is trying to address. So, Commissioner, do you have examples of Minnesota companies that are contracting to do work for the state that are not paying equal, providing equal pay for equal work? And, you know, how many cases are you getting? And what is your office able to do in those instances currently?
Commissioner.
Representative, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, there's a couple of different ways in which we can provide information to the committee as it relates to the scope of the problem. So if you look at the charges of discrimination that we receive, we investigate roughly 950 charges on an annual basis. I can think of a handful of cases just sitting here now which deal with the issue of discrimination concerning women as relates to pay. Not all of them relate as relates to contract, the individuals who are state contractors. In reviewing the state contractors, I do know of instances in which we have found issues with state contractors to the point of going so far as voiding the contract. What typically happens in that situation is we present our evidence, we allow the contractor an opportunity to respond, and then we reach some type of settlement as it relates to the specific dispute that we found. We haven't had to go so far as to voiding anyone's contract. So to your initial question, yeah, we do think that there is an issue concerning the underpayment of wages to women in the workplace through the cases that we investigate from discrimination and taking a look at information from contractors.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Commissioner, since we're keying in here on the contracting, I mean, how many cases would you say that you're investigating on an annual basis? In that specific arena, the contracting.
Representative, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as I sit here, I can tell you that it's a handful of cases. I don't have the exact number of cases. For the department, the ability to do effective auditing as it relates to this particular issue is impacted by the resources available to the department. We do think that and this is a policy choice which would be made by this respective body, that if resources are dedicated to examining that, we do believe that we would uncover and see more incidents of underpayment of women by state contractors or as relates to discrimination charges.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be helpful if we had the Department of Admin come down. Hopefully somebody from their department is here. I share the concerns that Representative McNamara pointed out, and this was why I asked the question from some of the business groups about what kind of impact is this going to have for our costs as a state overall. And as I look at this fiscal, the two fiscal notes that we have here that don't really apply to the entire package, as we've discovered, is what does this mean for the actual cost for the state? And if the Department of Admin is here, I think it would be helpful for them to tell us if they've actually explored that component. Because as I see it as written right now, this fiscal note does not take into consideration that we are adding another item to the task list, whether that's the Department of MnDOT in the contracts that they put out, or you name it, whatever contract that's out there. The businesses that are going to be applying for those contracts are for going out for those bids are going to add costs in order to cover having to go through all these steps. So I want to know, Representative Moline, if the Department of Admin can come down and give us best guess scenario of how much is this going to raise the cost of contracts, whether it's for roads, whether it's for Department of Health and Human Services, all of those different components. What are we talking about as an increase to taxpayers for this bill? So, Mr. Chair, is the Department of Admin, if they could come down, I'd be helpful to see what kind of digging they've done on this issue, if any at all.
Representative Moline.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't know if the Department of Admin is here. They did submit a fiscal note, and their cost estimate was zero. But, I mean, I think it depends on what the results are of the audits conducted by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. I mean, we know right now that women are only earning 80 cents to the dollar in the private sector. Yeah. In greater Minnesota, where I represent, it's 73 cents to the dollar. So if there are private contractors contracting with the state of Minnesota, making money off of the taxpayers, and they're paying women less, and that's discovered, then the department has the ability to order them to pay women the same as men. And I guess that would result in an increased cost to state, but in my opinion, that's long overdue, that female employees would be getting paid the same as male employees. So if that happens, and if we discover that private contractors are paying women less than men, and the department orders that they pay women equally, then that could result in an increased cost to the state. And I don't know if the Department of Administration has analyzed that or not, and I don't know if they're here to speak on it, but I mean, I think that maybe that just goes to a policy question, but that's the point of the bill, is to make sure men and women are paid equally.
But Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, you actually misunderstood my question. My question wasn't about the audits. My question is, as businesses are complying with this law, and I'm assuming that the businesses will comply with this law, much like they've had, as Mr. Commissioner Lindsay had pointed out, that they have been able to go through this process, and we've got good businesses in this state, right? I don't think I'm putting words into your mouth when I say that. So we have good businesses that have been operating the state. We just want to make sure that that keeps going in place. But we do need to consider, Representative Moline, that when folks are asked to do more paperwork, whether that's this bill or any other bill, that is going to add to the cost of government overall, because they're going to put those costs into the bids then that they submit to the state. Or, as Representative McNamara and other members have pointed out here today, they might not even go out for that bid. So then we're shrinking the pool for the number of people that go out for bids, and as you know, when you shrink the number of people that are competing for something, that raises the cost. So I think it would be helpful for us, since we're here in Ways and Means Committee, to have that consideration. I see that that's not part of the fiscal note. That was not something that was considered. And you know that when we're doing things for local governments, we always take a look at what's going to be the local impact for them. What's the fiscal impact to them for doing this? So in essence, what you're doing is you're putting an unfunded mandate on the state through this bidding process, because we don't really know how much is this going to jack up the cost of bids that we have for the state overall. And all I'm asking for is, assuming that they're all good and they're complying and doing what they're supposed to be doing, they still have to fill out all this paperwork and making sure that they are checking off all the steps that they need to do. And so that's going to drive up the cost of bids. And we don't have that in any of the fiscal information that we have here. And I'm concerned about that, especially what Representative McNamara has highlighted here today. So I think it would behoove you to take a look at that. And I would hope that the Department of Admin would be able to come here and give us some of that data, because I think that's going to be helpful, because it isn't just about, okay, what you've got here on just the agencies to get this program started. It's also about what does this mean for the contracts themselves and the cost that it's going to be to taxpayers on a long-term basis.
Okay, the next one on the list was Representative Holberg. I didn't see anybody from Admin come down, so I assume they haven't done that analysis that you're talking about, or if they've done it, they'll probably share it with us at some point. Seeing no further discussion, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is a question for you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming we're not going to move this bill at this point. It's clear that the testifiers don't know how wide of an expanse. If this bill includes MnDOT, it clearly should have went through transportation with this amendment on it. This is, I don't know if you want to have the discussion here, but there's serious implications if this includes construction contracts. I believe the parking ramp being built behind us is probably a Department of Admin construction contract, but there's road contractors working in there right now with backhoes excavating it. And is that one that's included here? If this applies to MnDOT, there's serious implications for existing things already out to bid. And we've got examples. The Commissioner Lindsay alluded to the St. Croix Bridge one, where when we went from a low bidder to a second bidder, it was $800,000. We're not talking about peanuts here. We're talking about people's lives and lots of state money. MnDOT contracts often include local match, where the local units of government are paying a significant part of that cost of doing business. If we're now going to be throwing out bidders or going into litigation, we should know. Mr. Chair, we're not clear who this current bill applies to. I believe that we need to take a deep breath here and step back. With the 24-hour amendment rule, this will be a mess when it gets to the floor, and we're not looking real right now as far as what we're doing here. And Mr. Chair, I guess I would rather you make the move, otherwise I'll make a motion.
Well, my intent is to move the bill out today. I think Representative Moline indicated very clearly what the issue is when she talked about the fact that women are on average paid less than men. You're talking to the original author when we were dealing with public employees, myself, Phil Rivness, on this very issue, and I'm sitting here listening to the discussion, and it's the same discussion we had back then, probably 30 years ago. But I think Representative Moline has brought forward an extremely important issue, and my intent would be to move the bill forward if that's the will of the committee here today.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, I actually support the premise of the bill.
That's good.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work. We don't know who it applies to. Our own nonpartisan staff testified that the original bill exempted MnDOT. Clearly, the fiscal note in the bill as it's currently drafted may include MnDOT. There's serious implications if it includes MnDOT. This bill is not ready to deal with those implications the way it is right now. And either we need to draft an amendment that exempts those construction contracts as it normally was intended, or we need to have it accurately reflected and at least have MnDOT testify as to what their implications are. Because it's my understanding that it did not cover MnDOT, but when I saw the amendment, I thought, I don't understand where they're exempt. And if it's the intention to move it, that's fine. You got the votes to move it out. But it's going to be a mess at some point for somebody to deal with. And it would make a lot more sense to fix in committee where we can get testimony from the people that need to testify about this bill. It's not ready.
Well, just one comment. The staff indicated in the question of who's covered and who's not, he indicated MDOT is covered. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative McNamara's concerns here, almost 100%, maybe not quite 100% of MnDOT's employees or the contractors are covered either by a contract, and you know, in a union, there is no difference between men and women. We get paid the same. We are covered the same for wages, for health care, for pensions, for brotherhood and sisterhood in a union. And if they're not on a MnDOT project, they are covered by prevailing wage, which is already there. And that covers men, women, that is gender neutral, gender blind. So I have no reason to understand why the need to have this particular bill held up so that it can go back to one committee or another. Women have been I need to be careful because I'm reverting back to my pipe fitter days. Women have been taking advantage long enough. It is time to stop. And I don't understand the business community or the members on the other side of the aisle who continually bring up questions about the validity of this particular bill. Under contracts and Department of Transportation, you have either prevailing wage or negotiated contracts, and there is no difference between men and women, so this should not have significant fiscal impact to the Department of Transportation.
Okay, Representative Anselm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney made some of the points that I wanted to make, but it should be clearly stated here that with regards to the construction sector, that is funded through appropriated public dollars, when a union contractor gets work, including the work over here at this construction site close to the state office building, if it's a union contractor, women are covered. Clearly, women are covered. We should encourage the bill, and the intent of the bill is to raise the wages of women in the non-union sector of the construction economy. That's a good thing. That is where, if there are any abuses in the construction sector, that's where they're likely to be, in the non-union portion of the construction economy. This is a good bill.
Okay, Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney and Representative Van Zyl, thank you for your comments. They're very well made. Teresa from Hastings, one of the better pipe fitters and welders there are, would be appreciative of what you have to say. Let me just say to the entire committee, there's things in here about 15 days. It's about a contract. This is about getting a bid thrown out potentially because somebody doesn't have a form filled out. There's a number of requirements in here. It aren't dealing with the intent of the law. This is day after enactment on existing things already out for bid with a 15-day requirement. There is no way MnDOT checked off on this. There's nobody here from MnDOT to claim that say, no, we're exempt, or yes, we checked off, and it doesn't work. This doesn't work, folks. It does not work, and it's going to be problematic, and we're going to look foolish fixing it on the floor when we're going to be passing notes that this is what MnDOT said, this is how it's going to apply. This does not work, Representative Moline. This does not work. And this is bad business, Commissioner, to be moving it forward and saying, well, they're going to do it, they're going to add one sentence. Believe you me, this does not work. And we can go ahead and do it. There's not a soul from MnDOT here. There's not an AGC lobbyist. Harry Melander's not here. There's nobody from labor, business, or MnDOT in the audience, and you're going to move a bill forward. Are you serious? Let's move it forward. I look forward to the discussion, Mr. Chair.
Representative, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
If I may, I want to make a point. Mr. Shepard already made this point, but just to make it again, this section is effective August 1st, 2014, and applies to contracts for which a State Department or agency issues a solicitation on or after that date. So that should answer the question, Representative McNamara, that you were bringing up about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I stand corrected because the original, the earlier version was day after enactment, and I did not catch that as we try and go through these long amendments. Yeah. Thank you for that correction. That's a very important one.
And
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner, you were about to say something.
No, Mr. Chair, you. That was a specific point I wanted to raise.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McNamara, and I had corrected that earlier as well, that this is, the effective date is August 1st, but there are plenty of people from the business community in the audience. Representative McNamara, this language where it, no department or agency of the state may execute a contract, That was in the last committee. This language has gone through the committee process in that regard. No one from MnDOT has contacted me with any concerns regarding that language. The only concerns the business community has brought to me regarding the current language are the ones that were addressed earlier by Ms. Larson in exchange with Representative Loon and Representative Holberg or Anderson, I think it was. So, you know, I hear your concerns, but this language has, in that regard, has gone through committee, and if you want me to double and triple check with MnDOT to see how this would impact their contracts going forward after August 1st, then I would be happy to do that. But I would ask for committee members' support in passing the bill through committee today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and I would like to renew my motion that House File 2536, the first engrossment, as amended, recommended to be placed on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
It's Representative Dorholt here. Representative Dorholt, I think I told you earlier today that I wasn't sure how long the first bill would take, but
that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Sometimes it's hard to predict. The chair moves that House File 2785, first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the general register. And if you could explain the bill and
sure, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is a call for a centralized accommodation fund. It's going to help address a problem that state government has the underrepresentation of people with disabilities in our workforce. In 1999, a little over 10% of the state workforce had a disability. Today is 3.2%. And obviously those are some alarming numbers, and we'd like to get to the bottom of that. The study would examine other government bodies in other states and in the federal government with centralized funds and examine if this is a practice we should adopt in Minnesota to diversify our workforce. The funds have been shown to save money by centralizing the administrative costs, give more buying power, thereby reducing the overall cost of state government, help hiring managers focus on the skills of people with disabilities, reducing the risk of unintentional or intentional discrimination based on accommodations. And the Minnesota Management and Budget has agreed to absorb the cost. You see the fiscal note is zero.
Okay, any discussion? Seeing none, then all those, I'll renew my motion that House File 2785, first engrossment as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those. So we didn't have the correct motion written out. It's not amended. Yeah. So I'll restate it. I will renew my motion that House File 2785, the first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
We now have Representative Murphy. And Representative Murphy, the chair moves that House File 2365, the first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment that DE2 that I would like to
put it in the order that you'd like.
Please.
Okay. The chair moves the DE2 amendment. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the DE2 amendment simplifies the bill, and because we listened, because we're still reacting to the fiscal note of March 17th, we don't want to bring a bill to the floor that costs money. And so the DE2, I think, will take care of that. We have military life requires frequent moves, and occupational licenses do not always transfer from state to state. As a result, military personnel and spouses frequently face unemployment or underemployment when they come to our state. We are trying to establish an expedited process for them to get their licenses. If they have already got a license in their state and they're coming to Minnesota and they want to pursue work opportunities in Minnesota, we would like to pass this legislation so that they could receive the licenses from the boards in a hurry or in a time so it does not cost them a lot of money. We are not asking these individuals to be held to any different qualification standards. We are just asking that the boards make a special effort to expedite the licensure for this small group of people whose lives are impacted by service to our country.
Okay, the amendment is before us. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The bill is amended. Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much. I would like to point out that we have dropped rulemaking. I would like to point out that we are not establishing temporary licenses. We are asking the boards that have been so cooperative with us all the way through this process, the boards that issue the licenses, to develop a process in which they could expedite the people getting the licenses, just like Minnesotans do.
Okay, any discussion on the bill as amended? Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Murphy. Expedite, could you kind of, is that 1 week, 2 week, or a month, or where? I know that was something I was thinking about when you.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair.
Fast as possible.
Representative Detmer, as fast as possible, making them first in line, but the board can decide on how they will develop that process because of Section 2. We will know in January 2015 what their plan is.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, would this apply to Guard and Reserve and active duty, all members that are currently serving or those that have retired or?
Any person in the military or their spouse that comes into the state for a military purpose, or anybody that's been out and have a license within the last 2 years.
Okay, any further discussion? Okay, I'll renew my motion then. Where House File 2365, the first engrossment as amended in this case, be recommended to be placed in the general register. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
The next one, Representative Kahn.
Sure.
Representative Kahn, being that you're a member of the committee, I can stop making a few. Would you like to make a motion?
Yes, I would like to move that this be the House File 2029 move to the floor, whatever you say.
Okay, your motion would be that you move the House File 2029 first engrossment be recommended to be placed on the general register.
I knew someone had the right.
We're all getting accustomed to the new motion.
I know.
Representative Davids isn't here to.
Mr. Chairman, this started as a bill that actually came from the Council on Black Minnesotans, and it started with a bill looking at the effect of not having enough it started with the black community on various arts institutions. We expanded it. We took a lot of the language out of rules and studies and so forth. We expanded it to artists from diverse racial and ethnic communities. We didn't name them because we knew we were going to leave out something or misname something. And with the language now, the we worked on this with the State Arts Board, and they said they could absorb the course. And it will just give us some information, and I think it will move our state forward in a way that we should move in this area.
Okay. Any discussion? Well, seeing none, Representative Kahn, would you like to renew your motion?
Renew my motion.
Okay. That House File 2029, the first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
We have now Representative Portman.
You were wrong.
She's not here. Oh, there we are. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there somebody who's willing to move?
We have your bill. It's the House File 2603. So the chair will move House File 2603, second engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. And I understand you have one amendment. Do you want to do the amendment before or after you explain the bill?
Before.
No. Okay. Chair then will move the A2 amendment. If you would like to explain the amendment, Representative Horton.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the amendment is just clarifying. It doesn't change the substance of the bill. It just adds clarification.
Okay. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Horton on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2603 has two provisions in it. One of them is a revenue bond program for the Department of Commerce. Right now, the Department of Commerce has revenue bond authority to make loans so that public entities can do energy improvements. They haven't used their $20 million in revenue bond authority because the statute didn't define very clearly what they could use that authority for. The proposal in front of you is from the Blue-Green Alliance, and it's an outgrowth of working with industrial power users to try to come up with ways that the state could be helpful as they pursue energy efficiency projects. And so it expands the Department of Commerce's revenue bond authority from $20 million to $100 million, and it expands the types of projects they can use it for. It includes public projects, but also large-scale industrial efficiency and small business energy efficiency. The second part of the bill has to do with the energy assistance allocation we made earlier this year. You may recall the Senate put an amendment on that, limiting the administrative expenses that the community action programs could use in administering the program to 5%. My language would change it to 8%. The caps have indicated they can't function effectively with a 5% administrative cost threshold. And what it would also do is say, out of that $20 million we appropriated to energy assistance, if there's any left over, it would cancel to the weatherization program. And that's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any discussion? Well, seeing none, then I'll renew my motion that the House File 2603, the second engrossment as amended, be recommended to be placed in the General Register. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. With that, thank you. And Ms. Conley, about tomorrow's meeting?
We meet at 10 tomorrow and 10 on Friday.
Okay, so we'll see you folks tomorrow. That meeting adjourned.